Today is the 1st of September, 2011. This is an interview with Peter B. Lutterman at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. My name is David Caruso. I'm here with Jody Roberts and Sarah Hunter, who will also be interviewing with me. So, as is pretty standard, I'd like to start at the beginning. I know that you were born in Weimar, Germany. When were you born?
I was born in Weimar on November 16th, 1931.
Okay. And so you lived there for, I believe, 8 years before
No.
You? No.
And maybe it would help if I try to give my early history
Sure. Quickly.
I lived in Weimar till 1933, when my father lost his job. My father, Ernst Lutterman, lost his job to the Hitler movement that Jews could not be employed by government agencies. And my father was the deputy of the audit department of a bank in Thuringen. We moved to Amsterdam Hoorn for 6 months. And my father could not find a job. And so we moved back to Germany, living with my grandmother, Julia Heilbrunn, in Gotha. And my father started his own accounting firm. I lived in Gotha with my parents until 1939. My father left in January for Great Britain, and my mother and I left in March. Interestingly enough, I had my first commercial flight from Köln to Croydon via Brussels on British European Airways in a DC-3. I won't go into my early history. Other than that, I was in school in Germany from April 20th, 1938 to November 9th, 1938, when Jewish kids were kicked out of school.
So you didn't start school until you were about 7 years old?
Well, it was standard.
Okay.
You had to be 6 years old, and then you started school on Hitler's birthday.
Hmm.
The Jewish kids were discriminated against. I mean, but we went to school like everybody else. Then I was in school in Great Britain, in a public school, which here is a private boarding school. I was very fortunate. I left Germany with my parents rather than in what was known as a Kinder or child transport. I spent the summer in Great Britain, in that public school. It was near the Dover. It was on the Dover coast, and I was in second grade there, which was interesting. In September, when World War II broke out, I was on the coast. My father. I won't go into what my father and mother were doing, but in any case, I was in that school, and the school was evacuated to the Midlands. I went back to Great Britain, to London, where my father's uncle lived, and stayed there until December. Interestingly enough, the first trip we had visas to the United States already, but we had to leave Germany quickly. And so we went to England temporarily. That delayed our coming here by about 6 months.
You Just to interrupt, you mentioned that you weren't going to go into what your father and mother were doing. Is that not something you'd like to talk about, or?
Happy to talk about
okay.
it.
Okay. So if I'd just like to backtrack a little bit to hear
sure.
a little bit more about your time.
Well, maybe you should ask some questions then, because I'm giving you the compressed version.
So you mentioned that your father had this government job, the deputy of the audit.
Well,
and lost
it was
it.
A... The bank was a government bank.
Oh, government bank, sorry.
Yeah.
He lost his job, moved briefly. He looked for another job and came back. Your mother, did she work while you were
no.
young?
No. My father had a PhD in economics, really in business economics. Was a certified public accountant in Germany.
Okay.
Was also the equivalent of a certified public accountant in England, which was fortunate. And so he started his own business when he came back to Germany.
Okay. And so just an accounting business?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Had your family always lived in Germany?
Yes. My grandfather, I knew one, I did not know the other. One was a physician who died in 1923 of stomach cancer from X-ray exposure. At that time, they didn't protect people the way
yeah.
they do now. My grandmother had land. My grandfather, that physician grandfather, was really revered at the time. My other grandfather owned a lumber business in a neighboring town, and was head of the Jewish community in that town till 1943, from 1900 to 1943.
Wow.
I can trace some of the family back to the 1500s. Others I can't. I haven't done that with yet. I don't know whether that covers it.
Sure. When you came back to Germany and your father started up his business. You were, I guess, about 3 or 4 years old at that point?
You know, I guess I was probably three.
Okay.
Give or take.
Do you remember much from your early years while you were there in terms of, you know, do you have any siblings?
No.
No. What did you wind up doing before you were in school? Did you just stay at home? And
well, mostly stayed at home.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish kids did not, or other kids did not really play with Jewish kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I played at home. We had a very nice house.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were certainly, my grandmother certainly, and my parents were upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a stay-at-home mom.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do remember some things. I'm not sure that it is really very germane to this,
mm-hmm.
To go into some kind of details of that. I remember being in Holland, for example, which I mentioned. I remember some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly remember the time in the late 30s, I remember going on vacation with my parents. Remember also the night my father went to concentration camp, Kristallnacht, which was the 9th or 10th of November 1938. I woke up to the second house invasion, if you want to call it that. And I remember that time quite vividly. I remember leaving Germany. I mean, I remember the details quite well. Again, I'm not sure that's really germane to this.
At the time, were you, I know you were quite young, but were you aware of what was going on politically and socially in the country? Or is that something your parents sheltered you from?
Well, yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
Spinach in Dutch is Nazi. And one day I was in the grocery store and saw spinach and yelled out, Spinazi, Spinazi. My mother clamped my mouth shut and said, "You don't say that." I certainly saw troops marching down the street in front of our house. I got beat up at least once on my way back home from school. So I always knew the differences. I mean, there was no question about that. But I did not know all the political intricacies. Interestingly enough, I read just recently in the... may have this title a bit wrong. In the Garden of Beasts by Erickson, Larry Erickson, or Beast in the Garden, one or the other, which details the American ambassador's existence in Germany in the years 32 to 34, 35, and you get there a sense of the things. And I obviously knew it after the war. I was well aware of the situation. But when I was there, did I know all the things? No. And in the town I was in, I think it was relatively calm. That is, there were no book burnings and things like that. No stores that I know of that were trashed.
Okay.
Or if there were, I certainly didn't know where.
What sort of interests, if any, did you have as a young child while you were in Germany? Were you interested? I know you were at home.
You know, I can't say. I don't remember.
Okay. So I guess just to move forward, your father one night was taken away to a concentration camp.
Right, and he spent only a week there.
Only a week.
He was very fortunate.
Okay.
The finance minister of the state of Thuringia needed him to collect taxes from his clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was asked to get out.
Okay.
And there's a separate story which he wrote letters for people to get them out of concentration camp.
Okay.
Now, all the Jews actually did get out of concentration camp, but many, of course, returned.
Right.
There was a recognition of my father writing letters in a little town in Thuringia this May called Tamar, and I'm actually going to do my own little detail discussion of that.
Nice. So do you know why your family decided to leave?
Well, they actually decided to leave considerably before me. They left the first time because it wasn't comfortable.
Right.
My grandmother, by the way, on my mother's side, was not Jewish.
Okay.
And stayed in Germany all during the war.
Okay.
I think they saw the handwriting on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't, my father had a good business, I think. And so they started looking, I believe, in about 1936, I'm not sure when, for a visa to the United States, which means you had to find somebody who would guarantee that you wouldn't be a burden on the state.
Right.
And then you had to wait for your number to come up. And that was a process, I believe, at the time, about 2 years.
Okay. So it was something planned sort of well ahead of the actual departure.
Yes.
Okay. So when you left, you got to go on a commercial plane?
Well, the British part was not planned.
Oh, the British part, okay.
We planned to leave in July of 1939 on the Neu-Amsterdam for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
When things got tight, my father decided he better get out of Dodge.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually flew to Britain to see a client. He had a client in Britain, and he had a visa, and he just went there. My father had an uncle in Britain who was vice president of the Eveready Company, and we got the Brits weren't anxious to have people come either. I mean, nobody was really anxious to have people. We got temporary visas to go through Britain,
okay,
with the idea of going to the United States. And then my mother and I followed.
Okay, so shortly after, a couple of months?
March.
Okay.
And if you don't mind real quick, so you were in school while you were in Great Britain. Was that because they thought that you might be there for a longer period of time before?
No, because it was good for kids to go to school. No, we were not going to be there a long time.
Okay.
We were scheduled. The paperwork had to be transferred from Germany to England, and bureaucracies take time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no internet, you know, it was all paper.
paper and carriers and all that.
So you figured about a 6 months delay.
Okay. Did your family know where they wanted to go in the United States?
Well, we had a sponsor, and the sponsor was a cousin of my father, and the sponsor was Kurt Friedrichs, and Kurt had been a professor at Göttingen in mathematics, and came here to the United States,
mm-hmm,
with a guy who had been fired from there. Courant,
mm-hmm,
the famous Courant of the Courant Institute. And Friedrichs actually became head of the Courant Institute after Courant. Anyway, he was our sponsor. They were in New Rochelle. And so we were either going to be in the East Coast or the West Coast. One of my aunts had already moved to Los Angeles.
Okay.
But they really didn't want us. They didn't need somebody else hanging on them. That's not understandable, but... besides, New York was a good community for, mm-hmm, German Jews. And so, however we landed there, we landed there.
Now, growing up, what languages were you speaking?
I started some English in Germany.
Okay.
In boarding school, I either spoke English or I didn't speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned the King's English very quickly.
Okay.
I came to the United States and I had trouble because now I had a teacher who came from Brooklyn. I failed. I had two troubles. My mother decided for a short time I'd go back into second grade. I wrote cursive writing. The kids only printed.
Mm-hmm.
So the teacher had to grade my papers. It was just not going to work. That was only for a short time. But I spelled the King's English. I spoke the King's English. That didn't work with some of these teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So my first half year, I was in trouble. but I spoke English.
Okay.
And during the war, I refused to speak German. I lost all my German.
Mm-hmm.
I told my parents it was my constitutional right not to speak German or understand German. And you can delete that little piece, I think, when you see the transcript. I don't think we have to get quite that. But it gives you a flavor.
All right.
How
is it transitioning otherwise for you and also for your family coming to the United States?
It was good and bad. It was obviously a relief to be here and not there. My father didn't have a job for 6 months.
Mm.
And of course, this was the end of the second recession.
Right.
He could not practice until he took some courses he needed. He was lucky. He got a lot of credit for his work. So all he had to do was, I think, take a year of U.S. Law and things like that. And he was admitted to be a CPA here. And basically, all his experience counted.
Mm-hmm.
So he could sit for the full exam first time. So that was pretty good. My mother had a job.
What did she start doing?
Well, my mother had been had been trained as a children's nurse.
Okay.
And had been a nurse, head nurse of the an infirmary in England, which served German and Austrian Jewish men. And she worked for a family. It was a connection, again, to back, as a nurse, caretaker, etc., housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that paid reasonably well, $1 an hour.
Right.
I certainly had some adjustments in school. I also had other adjustments because I never played ball. Mm-hmm. When you asked whether we did things, I mean, kids my age would have all played ball. I was not well equipped for anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really played team sports, even when I was young. School-wise, I had really no difficulty. And the other thing is where we lived in Kew Gardens, there was a large German-Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
So I had friends. And got into Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts and did things like that, which at that time was then a substitute for team sports.
Mm-hmm. During this period of time, you're going to the American schools. Clearly, World War II is also starting to rage. Did you... I guess what I'm trying to find out is, at what point was it in these early years that you started to develop any sort of interest in science as...
That's an interesting question. You know, I had probably by 7th and 8th grade, I had some interest in science.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very good math teacher, and I was good in math, being arithmetic and advanced. You guys get stuff now that I didn't get until college. But when I went to high school, I chose not to go to the three academic high schools in New York, where they were academics or the premier high schools. Bronx Science, Stuyvesant, and at that time, Brooklyn Tech,
yeah.
Instead, I went to Forest Hills High School, which was my normal high school,
mm-hmm.
but which was equal to any of those. 95% of our graduates went on to college. The competition was, it was the newest high school, too. It opened in 1942.
Mm-hmm.
Had a fine staff. And there was a guy there by the name of Paul Brandwine, who was a science head and taught biology. And he was just tremendous. And so sometime during that time, I certainly became very interested in science. I was also head of the audiovisual squad in that school, which was the teacher responsible, was the head of the bio lab, science labs. And at that time, I also wanted to be first an aeronautical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, of course, the hot thing. I mean, you know, planes, etc.
Right.
And I was good in science and good in math. I was a good student. Decided, and I was told by somebody who was head of the chief engineer at Republic not to go there because people like me weren't welcome in the aircraft industry. Mm-hmm. Now, things have changed considerably, but this was... So I decided, okay, I like chemistry, I'll be a chemical engineer. So when I went to college, I went for chemical engineering. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was maybe not hardwired, but certainly semi-hardwired in, mm-hmm. in my mind.
Can we stop on that real quick and just ask, clarify the time when you were graduating from high school and when you were exploring the aeronautical engineering?
What time that
so
was?
What year would that have been?
Well, I graduated from high school in January of 1950. I probably switched into this thing from aeronautical to chemical probably 2 years before.
How did you respond to the suggestion that you might not be welcome in aeronautical engineering?
You know, I probably just took it and said, well, I got a nice, you know, I didn't feel in Forest Hills and Kew Gardens, so you didn't feel anti-Semitism, if that's what you're asking. I can't answer it in a factual way. I don't remember what the reasoning was. I mean, the man was very well known. That was his advice. I took the advice.
During the time you were in high school, I have two questions. One, I want to hear a little bit more about what the science classes were like. But I also want to know a little bit more about if your family had certain goals for you. You mentioned that your father had a PhD, right? My wife's family, academics. So my wife, of course, is going to become an academic. Was that something that was, in some ways, expected of you? Were you?
Well, let me answer both questions.
Sure.
I think my family was very good. College was certainly in there,
mm-hmm.
but what I wanted to do was up to me.
Okay.
I wasn't pushed one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was any disappointment that I went to engineering rather than accounting.
Okay.
Now, the other question was...
I want to hear a little bit more about
the science were.
Yeah.
Well, at that time, of course, there were no AP courses, really.
Mm-hmm.
But there were honors classes. And so, when you went to high school, the first year you had general science, which covered the spectrum. If I remember correctly, no laboratory. But this was required. The second year was biology. And if you were good, you went to the honors class.
Mm-hmm.
And there you really studied biological systems. If you ask me, do I remember very much about it? No. But you also had to pass a Regents exam. Remember, are you a New Yorker?
I'm a New Yorker, so I'm quite familiar with the Regents exams.
Yeah, and you know, and this was a very competitive high school. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were three groups of people in Forest Hills. There were the people from Forest Hills Gardens who were at the high end of the economic scale. There were a large number of refugee kids
mm-hmm.
who were all very much college bound, if at all possible. And there was a very small group of people from Corona and so on who were going to be blue collar. But they didn't predominate. And so there was a lot of competition. And everybody just was that way. It wasn't cool to slack off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you took, after that, you took either honors physics or honors chemistry. Okay. And there were labs. Were weekly with lab experiments, and plus, you know, regular classroom work.
Regular rudimentary standard chemistry experiments and?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And rudimentary physics experiments,
right.
You know, falling ball,
right, right.
All those smart things. If you ask me what I actually did, I don't remember. And I aced all of them. I mean, it was just, that was just the way it was. And math, same thing. You had to take algebra, and you had to take geometry. Mm-hmm. And after that, it depended, you know. But the people who were going to go on to college took it, trig and so on. But there was honors English, too.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody had to take economics, everybody had to take civics, everybody had to take modern European history and American history.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of required, you know.
Right. Were there opportunities outside of your classroom experience and even some of the labs? In the honors courses, were there opportunities for you to do work with your teachers beyond what was in the normal
okay.
science curriculum?
Yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, these were commuter schools, as you can appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
We were not, so the school day was fairly boxed in, if you will.
Right.
Although all these schools did have teams, and there was after-school stuff. But Forest Hills, Asbong Science, and Syverson participated in what is now, I guess it's now the Infinity or something? No, Intel Science.
That's right.
It was the Westinghouse Science
Right,
Council.
The Westinghouse.
And we had the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the year I graduated, we did as well as Bronx Science, which gives you an idea. You're sort of looking at me. Bronx Science was in this area was the benchmark.
Bronx Science was the top school, and actually
remains that way. They
in terms of for people who wanted to go into a more science geared.
Yeah. But we were just as good.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point I'm making, and I participated. I got an honorable mention.
What did you work on for it?
Ah, a crystal radio.
Okay.
I grew crystals, and then I used it to build a little crystal radio. That's very mundane now. I mean, the things that kids do now are so much more advanced. But at that time, that was it got me an honorable mention.
What got you into this, the Westinghouse, this sort of science competition?
I think, if I remember correctly, we were encouraged by the head of science department, Paul Brandwein.
Okay.
But I couldn't vouch for that anymore. Mm-hmm.
And what, do you remember what made you think about growing crystals for a radio? I mean, was this just something like, hey, you know what, I'm going to... Or was this something
that
you were
interested
in?
I don't remember really.
Okay.
May have actually come out with my Boy Scout stuff on that form, but I don't remember.
During this period of time, I mean, you were doing you went through the Cub Scouts, the Boy Scouts. I'm assuming you got to leave the city a bit with the Boy Scouts. They had camping trips.
Yep.
I was a Boy Scout as well, so.
I was a counselor at 10 Mile River.
Oh, okay.
I had 2 years on the staff there.
Okay.
And went there, you know, before as a camper.
Mm-hmm. During this period of time, you mentioned, you know, when you first got to the United States, you didn't grow up doing the things that boys normally did.
I tried, but it was, it, you know, they had a number of years training ahead of me or experience.
So during your high school years, outside of your education, what were you doing with your own time? Were you at home reading? Were you sitting on the stoop with friends, chatting? Were you making trouble in the neighborhood?
Well, first of all, as I said, I was head of audiovisual, which took time and was a very engaging, contributory thing. I had lots of good friends in Kew Garden, and you know, we would play stickball and do other things. Certainly like the movies. But when you say make trouble, I don't think any of us were, quote unquote, making trouble the way, and you probably weren't either quite.
No, I don't know if you know Regis High School. It was in New York City itself, and I lived on Staten Island.
Okay.
So it was a 2-hour commute.
Okay.
Each way for me. So I left at 5 in the morning, got home at 7 at night. There wasn't much time to do anything.
But I had a very happy childhood or teenager or whatever, young adulthood.
Did you have other interests at the time? Were you an avid reader?
I read a lot.
Okay.
And I still read a lot.
Novels, histories?
It varies. I read a lot of history. I don't at the moment. Now I read, not trash, but excuse me. But I read a lot of mysteries now. I read some histories. My house has probably 3,000 books in it. Matter of fact, we are in the process of weaning books because we can't store anymore. So I read a lot.
Okay. Anything else that interested you at the time?
Chess. I played chess.
In tournaments or just for fun?
Just for fun.
Okay.
As a young kid, I did the violin. I gave it up for science, and when I was 13, that's at least what we said. My violin playing was not that great, and I just had a lot to do. I had it was the time I was being bar mitzvah. I had that plus my science and whatever else. I just violin went the way.
I'm interested in the being head of the AV work at high school. Can you talk a little bit about what that involved and interest in
we had technology? At that time, well, the technology were movie projectors, slide projectors, audio equipment. If a teacher wanted to show a film, we would make sure that the equipment was there. We would maintain the equipment. When the school had plays, we manned the sound booth, made sure that not only did it work, but that the mixing and everything was done. Now, the equipment was not at the level of the theater, but it was good equipment. It was state-of-the-art for 1942-43. We had 8-millimeter projectors. 16-millimeter projectors, slide projectors, and it involved day plus, you know, during the school day, as well as after school. So if there was a play production, and they were in rehearsal, we had to be there. So if you ask where my time went, well, I went there too. Does that help you?
Sure. So near the end of your high school career, you have decided to become a chemical engineer. It was sort of a given in some ways that you were going to go to college. When did you start thinking about colleges, and what colleges did you start thinking about?
Okay, that's an interesting question. Let me preface it by, when I was in eighth grade, I said, I'm never going to go in one of these football schools. I ended up at Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I applied, if I remember correctly, to NYU Engineering, which was around at that time, to City as a safety school,
mm-hmm.
or as a school. I really didn't need safety schools. I mean, I had a 96.3 average in high school. I was the top guy in the class and the number three. I was going to go where I wanted to go. That was not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at MIT and decided not to go there because that time was highly technical. It has changed.
Mm-hmm.
I applied to Cornell, to Rensselaer. Mostly, I did not want to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan was recommended to me again by this guy, Kurt Friedrichs, who had been there for a year. The other thing was that I was graduating mid-year.
Right.
And where was I going to go for mid-year admission? Well, not to MIT and not to Rensselaer. NYU would have taken me, City would have taken me. I think those are the schools I applied to. Michigan was, Peter Yort applied there, it's a good school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got into Michigan, and they took me in mid-year, and I didn't go out and visit and look at the place, as you do now. And I went there, figuring that things didn't work out. I had a number of potential backups. I got into Rensselaer, I got a scholarship to Rensselaer. But it was a September admission, and they said, you'd have to take many of your freshman courses. And I said, I'm already a sophomore. I mean, I stayed in Ann Arbor for the summer, and I had sophomore standing. I wasn't going to go back and take freshman courses. It was just ridiculous. And, you know, it's not just, yeah, it's the right place, the right time, and you got to be lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
So what was your perception before you went and started applying for colleges about what a chemical engineer might be working on?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't remember.
It seems like aeronautical engineering is so clear. Like, you're going to go design things that fly. But
yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what someone in high school is thinking about
when
they say, I'm going to go be a chemical engineer.
That's a very good question. I'm not sure that I'd have a better answer now than I would about what I thought then.
Mm-hmm.
I like chemistry. I like the change of it. Curious. I knew that they worked in that area. I still have this problem with the chemists, where chemistry ends and where engineering starts. And you know that's a problem with CHF. Again, not to be put in. You're laughing, but I deal with this all the time. And I wasn't interested in straight chemistry. I didn't want to be stuck in a lab. I wanted to build things and stuff. So, but if you ask me.
So would that be the distinction then, that you saw chemists as people who sit in labs and play with reactions, and chemical engineers as people who go out and build things to capitalize on the reactions that chemists do in labs?
You asked me whether I felt that way when I was 18.
Yes. Whether, because it, I mean, it is interesting to choose chemical engineering over just saying chemistry.
That's, it probably is, and I'm sorry I can't help you.
Okay.
No, I, it just...
Certainly. So you go to Michigan. Were you, was your family happy for that you were headed out, or were they
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. Okay. Or if they were unhappy, they sure didn't show it.
Mm-hmm.
And we all agreed that I would not stay at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had said you didn't want to, your decision factor for applying to schools was primarily based on you didn't want to be at home.
No.
Were there reasons for that?
Well,
not primarily, but that was a factor in your decision.
Well, I felt I wanted to get out
yeah.
and see other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
No, it shouldn't imply from that that I had an unhappy home life. I did not.
No, no, I think
I,
a lot
I,
of...
But
I think the assumption, at least for most kids, is at some point they just want to get away from home. And of course, going to if you live in New York and you go to a New York City school... you're probably going to be living at home, and most people do want to get away.
In yeah, I when I left in, I said I would not come back to New York. That I did say.
That's pretty rare for a New Yorker.
I did not want to come back to New York.
Why was that?
I just didn't like the city. Was as far as I and this is now, you know, many years ago, it was dirty and rushed, and yeah, there were nice things, but. I just felt didn't want to be there.
So what was it like going from that environment to Ann Arbor?
Quite a bit different. I mean, Ann Arbor at that time was 40,000, 50,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
But it had all the things that New York had in many ways. Didn't have good, many movies, but it had a good musical program, a good theater. Not that I always enjoyed that, but it was there.
Mm-hmm.
No liquor. It was a dry town. Well, and that's a big difference from New York, which was floating and
yes.
stuff. And I found the people friendly. I you know, I don't know. I can't give you rhyme or reason for that.
How is it, I mean, you're moving to Ann Arbor in winter, which probably not the easiest thing to do.
Well, it's interesting. First of all, you moved in a different way. You had a steamer trunk, which was about as wide as this table is wide, you know, and that was sent ahead by Railway Express, which doesn't exist anymore. No, it's UPS. And you got on the train at 6 o'clock at night, maybe it was 7, at Grand Central, and you rode. My parents even got me a sleeper, which was a luxury. I mean, my dad was doing well. It wasn't a luxury in that sense, but certainly... and the next morning at 7 o'clock, you landed at the train station in Ann Arbor, dark, cold,
mm-hmm.
and you took a cab to the dorm, and the house mother was there, and you got your room assignment, which was an interesting one for me, and that's how you got to school.
Why was the room assignment an interesting one for you?
Well, this was the time when the veterans were there.
Mm.
And it turned out I was assigned to a room, which was normally a single, but now they all, everybody doubled up. And my roommate, who wasn't there, was a senior chemical engineer.
Oh.
Which I think was an interesting pairing.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim didn't end up as a chemical engineer. He ended up as a minister. I got all his chemical engineering books. very inexpensively. They're now in Nigeria.
I have to ask that.
Well, I had two sets of engineering, or three sets of engineering libraries. The one which I got and then built on when I was in school. And I had that when I was in Baton Rouge and had in my basement.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the more current one, which dealt with chemical engineering and environmental engineering. Well, I know that is still history that we'll get into. And there was just too many books. So I was giving a talk at Cooper Union one day, about 5 years ago. And the head of the department, I talked and he said, well, I'm looking for books from Nigeria. And the books are worthless here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they weren't of the quality to put in the archive here. And so he came and picked them up.
Okay.
Which was great.
Yeah.
Now I kept a couple of them, but that's where most of that particular library resided. Anyway, Jim went into the ministry. He didn't fare well in chemical engineering. And I'm not sure he fared well in the ministry either. No, you're laughing as an aside. You happen to have a malformed jaw.
Oh.
And that's tough as a minister.
Sure. How was it, you're coming into Michigan in the middle of what everyone
winter.
Else is freshman year. Winter.
And
right.
And everybody's out. There are very few people in the dorms because
right.
it's mid.
It's their break, right?
Yeah.
It's their mid-year
yeah.
break. But what was it like coming in as a new freshman half a year behind everyone else?
You know, I got full set of classes because I wasn't the only one. There was a full class.
Mm.
And, you know, we took English and math and chemistry. And those of us who had been good chemistry students got the advanced chemistry.
Okay.
A year and 6 months. Analytical geometry, and we had to take mechanical drawing at that time. And I just took the classes. I mean, if you ask, was it tough because I came in mid-year, no.
Okay. So everything was sort of set up for large numbers of students to come in and take the classes starting
yeah.
mid-year. Okay. And how was it transitioning into college life more generally for you? Was it just essentially a continuation of high school in a sense? Or?
No, but I didn't have any problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you ate in the dorm, you made friends. I'd lived in the dorm for a year and a half. And I purposely picked schools like Michigan because I wanted some place where I didn't have only engineers.
Mm-hmm.
I figured that I could learn, get the other by exposure rather than by learning.
Mm-hmm.
And chemical engineering at Michigan had a very fine undergraduate advisor, or advisors, and one particular. And so it was an easy transition.
Okay. And the classes themselves were relatively easy for you?
Well, it was interesting. I have a U-curve. Very high freshman semester, a very high senior year, and the rest was. The freshman classes were easy because for ourselves was not easy. You know, the competition was not as tough as it was for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So that first, that I guess spring semester and the summer was your freshman
Yeah.
Here. And so those were relatively easy in some ways, I guess, kind of repetitive of what you
in
saw.
Some ways, yeah.
In some ways. You were doing various classes. You entered with the idea of being a chemical engineer. So I'm
assuming
you pretty much declared your major from the moment you arrived.
Yeah.
What was the curriculum like at Michigan? Was it very regimented where, you know, every chemical engineer takes all these classes and your schedule set for the next 4 years? Or did you have some flexibility to
Very
explore?
Little flexibility.
Okay.
I got some advanced credit from, I think, for German, for some course like German, because I took German in high school.
Even though you didn't want to speak it when?
Well, first of all, my grandmother came over and I had to relearn it.
Okay.
And I recently gave a lecture to high school students in German.
Hmm.
I didn't know whether I could pull it off. I've lost my train of thought, which is terrible.
I was just asking you about
the regiment. First of all, engineering required 144 credits.
Mm-hmm. Instead of the 124.
28.
128, yeah.
Yes, it was fairly regimented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you took three classes in drawing. You took a minimum of four courses in math. You took, if you're a chemical engineer, a whole series of required chemistry courses.
Mm-hmm.
The chemical engineering courses were required. You took one, you were required to take one electrical engineering course. You were required to take one mechanical engineering course, which repeated a lot of what you already had,
mm-hmm.
but it was there. You had to take an economics course. You had to take an accounting course. You had to take, I don't know how many credits in English. They were required. Now, you had a little choice in the English after the basic courses. But there was a block of English.
Mm-hmm.
I think now that we may have had, of that 144 credits, 10 credits or 12 credits where we could choose.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to be in the literature or something.
Right, humanities.
Humanities. So it was a fairly rigorous operation.
So how did you spend those few credits?
Let's see, I took one philosophy course, I think. And I don't remember what others I took.
So you said you had a U-shaped curve. What was happening during your sophomore and junior years? Do you recall were there specific sticking points? Was it just
partially social life, I think. Well, and I'll tell you, the first chemical engineering course was not easy. And you know who my instructor was? You know him, Stu Churchill.
Huh?
It was his first, I didn't know it at the time, it was the first time he taught chemical engineering. We've since become very good friends. The average of the first test was, I think, 10.
That sounds pretty normal for an engineering class.
And most of these professors were vets. They weren't taking no nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an interesting aside, and we've stayed friends for many years.
So, what aspects of your social life were taken away from your education? Was it just, you know, you were away from home, you had your time, you had your winter, you had your summer, where you invested in your academics, and then you realized I'm 18, 19 years old, I'm out on my own, and I can live a life? Was that pretty much what was going on, or?
I'm trying to think. I certainly dated,
mm-hmm.
and I probably got thrown over a couple of times. I really can't. I'm not sure I can make that connection.
Okay. So it just was.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what the chemical engineering curriculum was like? I mean, clearly you're going to a lot of lectures. You're being given a lot of information. Were you working in laboratories?
Okay. There were basic courses that were lecture or lecture recitation. I'm going to separate chemistry and chemical engineering.
Sure.
In the chemistry area, we had labs associated with every one of the courses. And we took analytical chemistry, quantitative analysis. And the only one that didn't have a lab in it was physical chemistry, because we'd gotten that other places. So there was labs there, or there were labs there. Then in the engineering school, or engineering, there was a basic laboratory course which dealt with, in the first course, or one of the first courses, was a materials course. And there was a lab with that, where we did welding and cutting, and also and looked at materials in every form. The book was A.H. White Materials, and I believe that's the title. And we did some, there was a foundry in Michigan, so we did some foundry work. And the things that nobody does anymore. All right? Then there was a course in chemical measurements, where we did distillation and I think it was the first time I saw a GC, or Monster now is a GC, but very rudimentary, which we built. All sorts of those sort of things. And then there were three courses which were, then there was the unit operations lab, where we did a lot of pilot scale things, with pumps or distillation or heat transfer, crystallization, all sorts of unit operations.
Mm.
The curriculum at that time was a unit operations curriculum. It wasn't until I got to graduate school that we got into the transport phenomena type. Transfer phenomena really started, the book Transport Phenomena really came out just about when I was a senior, or slightly thereafter. So that was sort of the ultimate lab course, okay? Plus we had two design courses. You had an equipment design course, and you had a process design course. That was the sort of the capstone course. And that was just very, so there was laboratory connected with it, both in chemistry and we had to take a physics course, a year of physics. And there was, I don't think we had lab with the physics course. I wouldn't swear to it.
So it sounds like the curriculum was such that you did have sort of the theoretical aspects of things, but you also had this practical component.
Yeah.
Right.
Unit operations would not be considered theoretical.
I was just thinking or reflecting on my own chemical engineering experience, where there really weren't labs. It was just purely, these are the equations, Johns Hopkins in the late 90s. And it was really just, these are the theories.
You were in the transport phenomena era.
Yes, yeah.
Well, and there is a great distinction. Mm-hmm. If you look at the book unit operations, which was the classic at that time, mm-hmm. Written by the people of Michigan, you can see the difference. Mm-hmm. And you probably used the one from, I can't think of the guy's name now, Minnesota.
I wouldn't be able to remember at this point. Okay. So long ago, so many books previous. I noticed that during your time, I think as an undergraduate, you worked as a junior technologist at Shell Oil.
Well, okay. I worked, that's not during.
Okay.
I worked while I was at school.
Okay.
And I was actually a lab instructor in the chemistry department.
Okay.
I taught qualitative analysis lab mm-hmm. for 2 years.
Starting when you were a sophomore?
Junior.
Okay. And you were doing that to supplement or to pay for tuition? And
To supplement my income.
Okay.
Supplement, I'll get pocket money or whatever.
Right.
I graduated with a bachelor's degree in June of 1953 mm-hmm. and went to work for Shell Oil okay. in Woodinville, Illinois. That was a permanent position, so it was not while I was in school, I had
okay.
left.
Okay.
I, with the intention of getting a master's. Now you ask about my parents. My father said, you got to get a graduate degree. Dad, I'm going to get a graduate degree. I'm going to go to night school in St. Louis. I had a couple of offers. Shell was, I think, the best one. And I was going to work at the Shell refinery in Woodinville, Illinois. It no longer exists. And I did. And the first guy I worked for was Hugh Guthrie. I don't know whether that name means anything to you. Hugh was president of AICHE. Quite a guy. Quite a guy. Anyway, I got this job, and the idea was that I was going to go to night school in St. Louis. Well, it turns out they didn't have night school in St. Louis. So now the question was, do I continue or not? Mm-hmm. I went to the head of the department, the chief technologist, guy, and his name is Dave St. Clair. I said, look, I can either, I owe you a year. You've hired me, I paid for my way down here. I owe you a year. Or I can go back to school. Because I can't do what I want, you know. Yeah. Well, he said, you do what you want, but you can certainly, we understand. So I went back to Michigan. It turns out that they had asked for my deferment, and my draft board refused deferment because they needed people. This was the end of the Korean situation. And I had quickly gotten to Michigan Graduate School. Don Katz, who was the chairman, department chairman at that time, I think I got a teaching assistantship, but I'm not sure. But I got into graduate school. 6 weeks later, I was in the U.S. Army. So that was a full-time job, mm-hmm. and I was a process engineer in the lube oils department. It was a very good experience. That plant went on strike while I was there. That was also a very interesting experience.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that.
Sure.
Also, of course, I want to talk about your time as an instructor at the U.S. Army Petroleum School.
Well, that follows that.
Yeah. Just to sort of end off your college years, you mentioned, you know, sophomore and junior year, your grades dipped a bit. Senior year, they came back up.
Right.
what was it for you that...
I was going steady with a girl. That was one thing. And I enjoyed the subjects that I was doing. I enjoyed process engineering. I enjoyed the lab. I don't know. It was just worked out that way.
Okay. Were you receiving any advice from the faculty members about what comes next for you? Were you? You mentioned you had opportunities to go to lots of different locations. Were those opportunities that you found on your own, or was the faculty? You had mentioned you could go to Shell, but there were other.
I had some other offers.
Right.
Well, at that time, and this was the end of the World War II boom. Michigan had a very fine, and still has a very fine placement service, and we'd have, just like you guys probably did at the time. We had companies come in, and they'd interview you, and then make you decide whether, you know, they were interested in you, and you'd go visit them, and you'd get an offer or not.
Okay.
And I don't remember how many offers I had. Probably 3, 4.
I think I heard Dave asking also whether or not there were any specific faculty mentors who might be giving you some advice on where
yes.
you might go.
I don't think so. I don't think I needed them at that point.
Okay.
Now, I mean, we had faculty mentors, and they were available if you wanted them.
So you take a job at Shell in lube oils, as you mentioned. What were your responsibilities for that position?
Well, really process operations. First of all, it was learning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was a green kid in many respects. But it was learning the operation, following the operations. We had a shutdown and we had a turnaround, meaning they shut the unit down to clean out and stuff. I was involved in that turnaround. Taking measurements, making sure that changes were made properly. Following production, is it? Quality.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't doing lab work, but I take the samples to the lab and make sure that the results came in, keeping track of things like that. Just general operations.
Is that what you saw yourself as doing as a chemical engineer?
I thought it was a good first start.
Okay.
Was I going to stay in that? No.
No.
And at Shell, you generally did. You grew.
Mm-hmm.
In a few years, I would have probably been an assistant department head or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And you wanted to stay in the Midwest area at this point, or is that just, it was more job opportunity?
Job opportunity.
Okay. So you're at Shell. Your family sort of chimes in with, you need to get a graduate degree. St. Louis doesn't work out, and so you wind up back at Michigan for a very short period of time.
That's right.
You were able to take some master's classes before you
had
to?
I was in a full master's program, and 6 weeks or 5 weeks, I said, thank you and goodbye.
Mm-hmm. So what
I wasn't the only one. I mean, this happened to people.
Right. What was that like for you, having to leave the master's program?
I was not a happy camper. The university, by the way, tried to get me a deferment.
Mm-hmm.
It went all the way up to the national board. And they said, well, it's already been decided. Sorry. And the board in Jamaica just was shy of bodies. They took, in the group that I was drafted with, there were four or five of my friends, my classmates from high school or from grammar school.
Wow.
Yeah, this was not fun time.
So where were you sent to?
Okay. Well, by the way, at that time, some people went to the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And it was you one step forward, right face, off to the Paris Island. I was lucky I didn't go to Paris Island. I don't think I would have lasted. I was sent to the Medical Replacement Training Center at Camp Pickett, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
There we were told, we met a young lieutenant interviewed us and said, you guys who are scientific and professional. And the way they picked that was if you had a certain number of years of experience and a technical degree, et cetera, you became scientific and professional. Well, they counted my teaching experience and that I'd worked for Shell.
Mm-hmm.
So I became scientific and professional. And this lieutenant called us in, who were scientific professional, and said, don't you dare go to OCS.
Why was that?
Well, guys who went to OCS, went through OCS, got their commission, and would go out with the troops. As mm-hmm. the second lieutenants, they weren't. That was not a very inviting career position. There was a high casualty rate. Well, actually, the Korean War, or the fighting had already stopped. There was novels. So it probably wouldn't have been as bad,
mm-hmm.
but neither here nor there. The other thing about S&P was we only got 8 weeks of training. And then we went off to our jobs. And we were somewhat protected. I don't have to go into that whole thing. Anyway, I also had some experience. I forgot work experience. The summer between my junior and senior year, I worked at the Mullen Research Lab in Michigan, working on the Bomark missile, doing corrosion studies, which also counted towards this S&P. Well, you know.
How did that come about? Was that you saw a job ad, or?
They were looking for people. And I had, at Michigan, you not only took some metallurgy courses.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Department of Chemical and Metallurgical Engineering. No longer, but at that time. And I don't remember how I got this job, but I got this job.
Mm.
And so I did corrosion studies. It was a very interesting summer. I also learned about computers. They had a computer there, and I don't remember the name now, but it worked on a drum that rotated, high-speed drum, and mercury delay line storage. You guys have never seen anything. This was as big as this room, and you programmed in hexadecimal. You're laughing, but
I can just imagine trying to program in hexadecimal.
And we used punch cards.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I knew about computers at that time. Worked with some very fine people. Anyway, that I forgot about that, but that was
okay.
Part of the experience. Anyway, so I became an S&P. And my first assignment was to be at the Army Chemical Center,
mm-hmm.
where they were working on nerve gas. And this is kind of interesting. It'll go later, because I came back to nerve gas later in my career. I went there after my 8 weeks. And, of course, people were very jealous of these S&Ps, because we weren't going on to more training. We were getting a job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I and another guy drove up to Edgewood Arsenal, And I came there, and a lieutenant says, "Letterman, you're not going to stay here." "Why?" "You can't get security clearance." I said, "Sir, I have a security clearance." "You what? You're foreign born and you have security clearance?" I said, "Yeah, I have an Air Force secret clearance." So he says, "Son, this is the Army, not the Air Force." Well, it turns out I knew the rules better than he did. I could get security clearance, but and they wanted me because of my corrosion experience.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd already asked the Adjutant General for a transfer because S&Ps had to be, transfers had to be, go through Washington. So I was the post librarian for some months, or the assistant post librarian, that was nice. And now I was transferred to the Army Petroleum School.
Okay. So that's how you wound up at the Petroleum School was?
Yeah, and first it was, I almost didn't wind up there because I got back to Fort Lee and they said, "You only have 8 weeks of training. You need more." But I had, you know, Michigan counts. There was a young lieutenant there who had been president of my class. And I knew Jack well. And Jack made sure that I was protected. And he went to personnel and said, "This guy, he can't do this." So all of a sudden on a Friday, I get told, "Can you be out of here by and be up in New Jersey by Monday?" "Oh, yeah. Here are your papers. Get them all signed. And you have to clear the base. You had to get it." And I reported to the Petroleum School up in Caven Point, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
which was in Jersey City, and lived at home for 6 months because there was no base. And then we went back to Fort Lee, Virginia, where I taught at the Petroleum School only officers, and I also wrote that there was a course for senior officers, the Advanced Quartermaster Guard School course. And part of that, they had just started a course in process industries. In other words, they wanted to know, these guys to know, guys and gals, to know the how the products that they were buying were made. And they needed a chemical engineer. I was the chemical engineer. I was Private Letterman. I wrote this course and taught it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Captains to colonel. It was very interesting. I'm giving you an overview, not details. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, so I am curious what your family's response was, given that your father said, you know, get your graduate degree and then you wind up in the Army. Was that problematic for them?
No.
It's just, okay.
Hey, that's the way life is.
Mm. And I guess during this period of time, how were you... Were you thinking any differently about what it is that you wanted to do?
No.
No.
I decided I was going to get my graduate degree, a master's degree only.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught petroleum technology, which was lab, mainly lab stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I became the technical advisor to the commanding officer of the school, since I was the only chemical engineer at this place. I was a private holding GS-11 spot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spent my 22 months, and then I had, and then they offered me a commission if I went to OCS, and I said, no way. You know, I got my, it wasn't a discharge, separation.
Mm-hmm.
I had wanted to go in the Navy before. I had applied for a commission in the Navy as a patrolling officer, but the Navy wouldn't take me because I was draftable.
Okay. Why did you want to?
I knew they had a patrolling reserve. I had worked in patrolling. I thought that was a good thing for me to do.
Okay.
At what point was this when you wanted to?
Probably just about the end of my school. Was getting my bachelor's degree
okay.
and working in show. Anyway.
So it was more just a job opportunity then?
Yeah. Well, not job opportunity. It was a way, I know I was drafted. Well, this was a way to avoid being drafted.
Sure. Better to be on a ship, I guess, at that point.
Well, and while I was at Cape Point, we ate on the carrier Mission Bay because we had no messing facilities. So we drove down there all the time. Anyway, I got out, separated, and went back to school.
Okay.
I got an early separation, so I could go back. And now I was a teacher. I got a job at Michigan as a teaching fellow. So I taught while I was going to graduate school. Based on my teaching experience, I had probably had as much teaching experience as many of the junior faculty had.
So you had mentioned just quickly that part of the reason your grade curve was at U and came up at the end was that you were seeing someone rather steadily. You also then, after graduation, move about 6 times around the country in about 2 years.
Well, you want to know about this girl?
Well, I'm just wondering if you had any extra concerns post-graduation besides just the fact that the U.S. government was moving you around the country.
No, the young lady broke up with me shortly after I moved to St. Louis.
So you returned to Michigan in 55. I'm assuming there was no problem with you resuming.
Absolutely not.
Were you paying for that education as well? For when it was just, when you were starting to pursue the master's degree, was it something that you had to pay for, or?
A, I was on the GI Bill.
Okay.
B, I was a teaching fellow. Teaching fellows don't pay tuition at that time in Michigan. Now, the salary was not exactly humongous, but I was rich. I had the GI Bill, and I was making $1,600 a year during the school year as a teaching fellow. So between the two of them, I was in seventh heaven. Seriously.
Yeah. When you returned to Michigan, did you know any of the people that were also pursuing their master's at the time? Was anyone familiar to you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So there were people that you had done classes with before? And
I certainly knew the faculty well.
What was it like being both a student and an instructor in the same department at the same time?
Didn't bother me at all.
No, didn't make a difference?
No, it probably gave me an advantage.
Okay.
Because I knew the faculty. And some of the faculty were friends of mine. I mean, it wasn't just... and the guy who really became very friendly with was Bronner Williams, who passed. Very friendly to the point where after I left, we continued our relationship. I would consider him one of my mentors. I felt comfortable enough to go in to see the department chair and tell him once that he wasn't treating me fairly. Because he made one guy an instructor and not me. The guy he made an instructor was Dick Ballsizer. That name is familiar to you. Dick, by the way, is not well. And that's not for...
That can be deleted.
Huh?
That'll be deleted.
Yeah. Friend of mine, but... You know, most graduate students don't feel that comfortable going into the boss and saying, who's paying your salary? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to ask. I noticed that you did have publications coming out with Bronner Williams on the liquefaction of natural gas.
Right.
And so I did want to get a little bit more into...
Why I did that?
Your work, why you came to liquefaction, but also, I mean, clearly at some point you decided not just to pursue your master's, but to get your PhD.
Okay.
I
said I was going to get a master's degree, and my father said PhD, and I said master's, one thing at a time. I was going to take a master's degree and then go out and be a process engineer. And I was I was teaching the chemical engineering measurements lab, and I was sharing an office with a guy by the name of Alex Weir, who was not yet, I think at that time, instructor. He said, Pete, you take the PhD qualifying exam. I said, I'm not ready for that. Take it. First time is free. And I passed. So it wasn't free in that sense. I squeezed by the practical part. Anyway, I passed. And, you know, once you did that, you're hooked.
Right.
So that was the transition to the PhD. At Michigan at the time, they required a prelim exam after you passed the qualifying. And the prelim exam at that time was a consulting problem. You got 21 days to write a consulting report. And I was given the problem. We're company XYZ, and we have some money to invest. We think that liquefied natural gas is a good thing. Tell us whether we should go into it, if we should, what at what level, and if we should, where should we get the gas, and where should we sell it in 21 days. That's a, and they were all in that sort of thing, very comprehensive. And I think a very, at that time, very good thing. Well, the one thing I knew nothing about was shipping this stuff. I mean, I'm a chemical engineer. I'm not a ship guy. Well, fortunately, there was a report had been done in Michigan on shipping natural LNG. Well, on top of that, Stu Churchill had been consulting for Shell on LNG.
Mm-hmm.
Don Katz, who was head of the department, had been, was head of the Coast Guard Advisory Committee on Safety, and they had looked at shipping LNG in barges up the Mississippi. So, okay, Letterman gets this problem, and 21 days later he has to produce a report, which I did. And normally these reports were then graded and then put away, and somebody else would get the same problem. Well, in this case, somebody approached, I don't remember whether it was Stu Churchill first, or Don Katz first. There was the American Natural National Gasoline Producers Association was having the annual meeting in Houston, and this was in 1957, and they needed a paper. They wanted somebody to talk about LNG as a keynote. I mean, crazy. Remember, I'm a graduate student. I mean, admittedly, I'm a more experienced graduate student than many graduate students, but I'm a graduate student. So Don says, I can't do this. And Stu says, I can't do this. But what about Letterman? So Letterman gets the job to go down and give this paper. And I had been planning a party for my now wife, we're not even engaged, for her birthday. I had to cancel all this. No, that was separate. But anyway, I went down there to Houston, and I gave the paper. And a guy from Parsons Brinckerhoff came up to me and said, you stole some of our data. And I said, it's just plain thermodynamics and then costing. But if I'm that close, I must be pretty good. He walked right away. And hence my first 13 publications.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about luck. Does that answer the...
Yeah.
So did they not want to do that presentation, or did they not feel like they could do that presentation?
Well, they felt they were in conflict. That Shell was in studying this.
Sure, sure.
And they felt they would have conflicts in doing that. And so...
I noticed that, with Primer Williams, you have those publications on natural gas. I know this, well, I'll come to it, I guess, at your time at SO Research. You also do have an article coming out about computers and chemical engineering education.
Okay.
I'll get back to that. What I'm actually more interested in right now is how you came about your thesis.
Okay,
for
fine.
Graduate school.
Be happy to do that.
Okay.
The first thesis subject I wanted to do was to study the chemical industry in Michigan and see where it was going and what it needed,
mm-hmm.
what it had and what it needed. And that was obviously not a normal chemical engineering
mm-hmm.
dissertation. Non-experimental business. The business school said, this is great. We don't have the expertise to do it. Letterman should do it. The faculty voted 50-50, right down the middle, that I could do it or couldn't do it. And so Don Katz called me and said, Peter, we'll support this if you also get a PhD in business. And I said, one is more than enough. and so that went down the tubes. And my thesis advisor was going to be Brian Williams. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that was preordained. I then suggested a topic to do with LNG, with the physical prop when you freeze, or not freeze, but to liquefy. You have some heavy ends. Do you know what heavy ends are?
No.
Okay. Heavy. Liquefied natural gas is mainly natural gas, which is methane. But you have some materials in there which are heavier hydrocarbons. And you even have in most natural gas little bit of benzene. Or when you cool this down, they freeze. And what do you do with it? Now, my papers didn't address that, by the way. And I was going to do a study on the freezing and removing the stuff. At which point, Guy Raymer, Ricky, it wasn't Ricky Kobayashi, it was a guy in Kansas, and also a Japanese. We'll have to look at that name. Called me up and said, Peter, if you do this, you're going to force me to publish. Well, that's the death knell. You don't do that. So I said, well, try number three. And zeolites were just coming out at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a new thing. And I said, well, when I look at zeolites and how they nitrogen and methane, you can enrich methane. Can you, you know, what do you do with zeolites? How do they act? And so we got it by default.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, your first idea for a dissertation was not experimental.
That's right.
Why? I mean, what was it about the business model, in a sense, that interested you more than...
An experimental one?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was already... Remember, I had been in industry.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that this was an area that we hadn't looked at. I saw... I was interested... And I guess this comes back maybe to my gene pool. My father had been... in business, or certainly, Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of a, I don't know whether it was a connection, but I just felt this was an important thing. And Brian Williams thought it was important too, and the industry thought it was important. It was not something that I just, because they weren't looking at the future as much as they do now.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of curious whether or not you were, if you had a preference for, or some of the scientists that I've spoken with love being in lab. They love doing experiments. They love working with their hands. Some of them feel that lab work is necessary, but they kind of like thinking about bigger problems. And I was wondering if you enjoyed being in lab and doing lab work, or if you actually preferred thinking about the consequences of that lab work more. That's where my question was coming from.
Well, I did not particularly enjoy doing lab work.
Hmm.
I mean, it was necessary, it was there. I was looking at, I was really process oriented.
Hmm.
Now, this was the next step, obviously. But if you ask me, was this willful? Probably not. It was, it just came.
Can you tell me a little bit about, since you wound up having to do lab work, can you tell me what it was like pursuing the research for your thesis in terms of, you know, I'm even curious down to the what you were doing on a daily basis sort
okay.
of thing.
Well, my day was really split between teaching.
Right.
And I ended up teaching every chemical engineering course except thermal during my time.
Mm-hmm.
My day was split. And I had a, built a piece of equipment with the help of our mechanics where I, you know, where I could do low temperature work. And my day would be, I go in the morning, start the experiment, let it go to equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
And then take readings, or come in and take readings, and do that on a routine, regular basis. That after I debugged the equipment. And Michigan had a couple of accidents, and so safety became a fairly important thing. I was working at high pressures and low temperatures, so this machine had to be safety inspected.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not just, there was no glassware involved in this thing. And it had a fairly heavy shield on top, and I needed the liquid nitrogen for cooling or
mm-hmm.
dries. So you know, there was a lot of repetitive routine work to get this done.
What sort of days, how long was each day for you? I mean, were you getting in at 5 in the morning and leaving at 7 at night? Was it a normal average work day, 9 to 5?
I don't even remember.
Okay. I'm guessing, though, probably no, you weren't pulling all-nighters on a regular basis.
No.
In your time, the time that you spent in lab when you weren't teaching, were you with other graduate students?
No. I had a lab.
Okay.
So they had an office. And they were down the hall from each other.
Mm-hmm. So in a certain way, you were acting, well, I guess I should start with, were other graduate students working in labs together on projects? Or was the setup such that once you were a graduate student, you got your lab, you did your work, and you were...
It varied.
Okay.
Some people who worked on grant, this was, my research was not supported except by the department.
Mm-hmm.
If you won a grant or a industry support, a lot of industry support at that point. For example, The Wolverine FinTube company support a lot of research on heat transfer with FinTubes. The guys who did that kind of work, all in one room, large room, were doing heat transfer experiments. On the other hand, somebody did some work on the constant volume heat, specific heat of propylene or something, and he worked by himself.
Okay.
It just varied.
So it seemed like the projects that you had were very solitary projects. Can you talk about the
not that I had or that we generally had?
That you had.
I had, I had a project
it was
that
just
I.
You.
Yeah, that was me.
Can you talk about your experiences with the broader graduate community while you were at Michigan?
I was part of that community.
What was it like?
First of all, we had seminars and stuff, and we were all involved in that. We gave seminars. We had parties, not always. And in my case, after 2 years, I was married, and so I was not part of the single community. I was part of the married community, and a number of my colleagues, chemical engineers, were married, and we would play bridge. We'd have dinners together, so it was not the type of thing that you might imagine. It was a much more family, if you will, family oriented situation than law graduates.
Do you want to talk at all about where you met your wife or what was going on with her?
Happy to do that. I met my wife in Michigan. She happens to be a graduate of Forest Hills High School, but not in my time. When I came back to Ann Arbor, I knew a number of people still from my days as an undergraduate. They were very junior, I was senior. And I went to one sorority house where I also parked my car. I was lucky I had a car. At Michigan, you couldn't have a car until you were 26. Except if you were a teaching fellow. And then you could have a car. And so I parked the car at the SDT house. And I knew the house mother. And anyway, I was there after a football game. And a woman who was I knew, who was dating a friend of mine, said, "Oh, here's number one for Matt." Not number one, but she kept introducing me to people from Forest Hills High School. It turned out there were five or six women in that house from Forest Hills High School. Sue was the last one. And we dated and we didn't date. I mean, it was sort of on and off for about a year and a half. And then we got serious. So that's how I met her. And I married her between her junior and senior year.
What was she studying at Michigan?
Political science. Ask more.
Oh, I was just curious about, I was just trying to figure out what else was happening outside of the lab as well. I was trying to add a little context.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask as well. I mean, asking about graduate student life, you also mentioned that you were also close to faculty members. I'm assuming you were did you spend time with them outside of?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Just
and, you know, Ann Arbor football, so on football weekends, and I had enough seniority that I had seats with the faculty on the 45-yard line. So the way you got football tickets was, as you gained seniority, you moved down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And since I had, and 4 years was the maximum, and since I had that, I could go in with the faculty that I did.
Nice. Were you doing anything else outside? I mean, okay, so you were working on your dissertation, you were teaching, so you had grading to do, you're going to football games. Were there any other things that you were pursuing?
I attended concerts.
Okay.
I had friends from my undergraduate days who I visited in Detroit.
Okay.
And we're still friends. I had a very pleasant life. And I had my own apartment for a while. And I moved. And then I became the fraternity advisor. I moved into the fraternity house. And that was a kind of interesting disaster. well, you know, here I am, 24, 25, 26. I stayed there for a while, and then I got my own apartment back, a different apartment. I knew people in town too, whose kids had been with me in class, and I'd go out and visit them.
Okay. During your, while getting your PhD, I mean, in some ways it was, you hadn't intended to get it, but you were getting it anyway.
Well, by the time that came around, it was, I mean, and so I said, once I passed the prelim, and I don't know whether I hadn't intended to, I just said I would do one at a
time. Right, right. But what did you see yourself doing? What did you want to do with
After
that
I got
degree?
My PhD.
Yeah.
Go back into industry.
Okay.
Into process engineering or something.
So you definitely didn't want to stay in academia and teach and
At that time, experiment? No.
No. Why?
Well, I felt that I needed industrial experience.
Okay.
I was not a researcher.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to spend my life in the lab. And when we talk about my future teaching, you'll see what how it works out. Anyway, so I wanted to go back into industry.
Mm-hmm.
I did not consider academic jobs when I got my PhD.
Did you receive any advice or feedback from the faculty members you had spent so much time with?
You know, I'm really not, I'm sure Brimer and I talked about it, but whether, I can't recall that I really, you know, got that.
Okay. Because, you know, in some ways I'm always curious to know, in some contemporary scientific cultures, those who go to industry are seen as those who are going to the dark side of science,
yeah.
Right? And I was wondering if that sort of culture, that perception existed.
No.
No. So it was acceptable for you to be moving.
I don't know what percentage of my colleagues went into academia versus into industry. I've never given that any thought. But I will tell you that there are a number who went into industry and stayed in industry.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number who went to academia and stayed in academia, and then there are people like me.
So I'm curious a little bit about, you know, you've got this interesting relationship with the other faculty members where you're a colleague, you're a student, maybe they're formally and informally mentoring you. Was that unique to you, or was that representative somehow of the community of the graduate program at Michigan at the time?
Well, there were a number of teaching fellows, and there were a number of instructors, and I ended up an instructor, as did two others. By the way, one of those stayed at Michigan, went into academia, then went into government, then went into industry, and that's Nick Ballsize. The other instructor went to industry, stayed in industry. I think Bob is dead now. And there's myself. were the three instructors at that time. Oh, I'm sorry, there was a fourth in metallurgy, and he went into academia. So there was no set pattern.
But I mean, in terms of the relationship that you had with the other faculty members at Michigan, do you think that those people you just mentioned had that same more complicated but also friendlier relationship with the other faculty? Or was that something about your experiences and your relationship with that faculty?
Well, we were each different. Bullsizer had been a football star, his relationship, I think, was similar to mine with other people. I think the others, we all had relationships with at least one, good relationship with at least one faculty. Now, was that true of every graduate student? They all had a mentor, if you will. Maybe not to the extent that we had. I mean, I could go to Williams' house for dinner. Even when I was in the Army, when I came back, I stayed at his house. I mean, it's difficult to make those kind of comparisons. And I'm not even sure I knew them.
It just sounds like, to a certain degree, you were more of a colleague when you were a graduate student and less of a student. So the distinction between the faculty and the graduate students, which we normally think of today, didn't
apply to me.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay. I also noticed while you were a graduate student, you did do some work with R.L. Norman. On the production of ethanol amines. Is that... I remember seeing a publication on your list about
it. I don't even remember that.
Okay, so it wasn't that significant a point, a part of your graduate career. When you were finishing your PhD, you're married at this point.
Oh, but you wanted to talk about the computer work.
Well, I noticed the publication came out in 63. Right, the Computers and Chemical Engineering Education publication came in 63. So that was at your time while you were at ESSO, so I wasn't sure where it would be best to...
Well, it fits into the graduate.
Okay.
That's why I returned to that. Don Katz got a grant from, I believe it was Ford, for computers and engineering education. Mm-hmm. That grant probably started in 56, maybe, I'm not sure. And he then looked at that, or had people in each discipline look at that. And I went, Bob Norman, R.L. Norman, who was the other teaching fellow, became instructor, was also on the computer. The other people who benefit from that, you'll know the name Larry Evans. Larry was a couple years behind us. And there were others. I can drop the names if you want. Any case, we did work in computer, how computers fit into chemical engineering. And I developed a program for liquid extraction. Why that? It was a simple one. And as part of that project, and gave a paper on it at the time. And that may have only come out in 63, but that work was done while I was...
Okay.
And I was part of that team and got one publication.
Was this something that was assigned to you, or was it something that you volunteered for? I mean, was it a topic that interested you generally?
We were certainly, because this was a big grant, we were encouraged to participate.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to. I was teaching, I think, unit operations at the time. So this was a natural thing to do. I had worked with card readers when I was at Shell. So it just worked. You know, when you ask specifics like that, I have to answer the right place at the right time, and you just do it. And I know that may not be a good answer, but that's the way it is.
It's also, you know, doing an oral history interview, we have the ability to see what happens later on, and so we always try to reflect back to see where something may have started from. And of course, you know,
certainly it started there.
Okay.
I mean, my computer work, what I did or have done, started there.
Okay. Anything else about his? All right. So, you're finishing your PhD. You're married. You're going back into industry. Where do you want to go?
You mean location-wise?
Location-wise, you have this. You have an interest in process.
Well, first of all, I came out at a time when jobs were not that easy to get.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many interviews I had. Shell was not going to hire me back. Although I think they would have, but the rule in Shell was if you left Shell, you left.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed petroleum companies and chemical companies. And the question is, where am I going to get a job? Not locational.
Mm-hmm.
And I got, I think in the end, two offers. One from Pure Oil, which no longer exists, in the Chicago area, and one from Esso in Baton Rouge. I had interviewed Esso in New Jersey. They didn't make me an officer, but Baton Rouge did.
Mm.
One of the questions, and so those, between those two offers, we felt that Baton Rouge, even though it was an area we had never been in, was the best deal.
Why was that? Can you tell us a little bit about the conversations you were having at home?
Yes, I'll tell you, but I think, I'll tell you, but I don't think that ought to be part of it.
We can skip it then if you prefer.
Huh?
We can skip it then.
No, I'd be happy to talk about it, but it would be something I think would really.
Okay.
Remember, this was the time, this was 1960. Actually, I was interviewing 58, 59. I had been in the South before. My wife had never been in the South. And the South was in a bit of an upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
We were very much attuned or concerned about equal opportunity. And so going to the South was a major change. We wanted to make sure that we didn't go into segregation, big segregation issue. And we found that we visited Baton Rouge, and that was a discussion whether we would do that or not. We also wanted to go to a place where there was Jewish community. That was important to us. Well, Baton Rouge is an interesting town. About one-third, at that time, one-third black, one-third Cajun or natives, and one-third displaced Yankees, because of a lot of industry, big university, fine black school, Southern University. So we found that would be accepted. Sue figured we wouldn't stay there forever. She didn't say it at the time. And I didn't consider that at the time. But first of all, when you were at any of these petroleum companies, you moved. So it was not that. But it was and it looked like a good community.
Did you have any discussions with any of your faculty colleagues about the job offer, moving to Baton Rouge versus going somewhere else?
I don't remember.
And did you have any children at the time?
We had one on the way. It was a race between my PhD and his being born.
Which one?
I won. He was late.
So you decide to take the position at ESSO in Baton Rouge. You have a son. Well, where was your son born? In Michigan or in?
In Michigan.
In Michigan.
He was born in Michigan, and 5 days later, I was on the road driving to Baton Rouge.
Okay.
My wife flew down later with him.
Okay. So a very young family starting life in Baton Rouge. What? I know that you were working at ESSO Research Laboratories as a chemical engineer. What were you hired to do as a chemical engineer there?
That's an interesting question. I was hired as a process engineer.
Okay.
Without specific assignment to start, you know, that is, I got the job. I had the job probably a year and a half before I went down there. And when I came down there, I got an assignment to work in polymers, ethylene, propylene, copolymer, as the assistant project leader, working for a guy who had a PhD. There was lab work being done, and we were building a pilot unit.
So your job essentially was to oversee the development of the pilot unit, where you
oversee the operation of the pilot unit, okay. Oversee the data analysis. We had a guy who was a chemical engineer, but was a data clerk.
Mm-hmm.
Had been with the company a long time. Okay. Make sure that the things they had operators that were running the pilot plant. I didn't have to run.
What was your work schedule like? Was it relatively standard hours?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, yeah, we had standard hours, but you're a professional. You work what's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. Number two, and you remember the pilot plant was operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. and we had had training too. You know, we went through refinery safety training, fire training, all those sort of things, which is important. And then this unit went from a 10-gallon butyl reactor, that's a type of reactor, to a 1,600-gallon commercial size.
Mm.
And the startup, we were working 12 on, 12 off, because we were providing technical advice to the operating people. If the operator called me at midnight, he called me at midnight. And I'm talking also about the pilot.
Mm-hmm. How is it balancing this position with your new family or your new expanded family?
Not a problem.
Not a problem.
My wife at that time was a stay-at-home.
Stay-at-home.
She had taught at Michigan high school,
mm-hmm.
and at that time, if a woman was pregnant, they got kicked out of school or out of their jobs.
Right.
And so the last 9 months, six months, she was not working.
Okay.
And we came to Baton Rouge, she really wasn't working.
Okay. So while working on the pilot plant, scaling up these reactors, what did you encounter any problems with the project that you were given, other than general, something's not working here, it needs to be tweaked, or
Well, there were a couple of interesting problems. One, this was not a catalyst, and very sensitive to water. And we could tell when the polymerization, and this is the commercial unit, when the polymerization wasn't going well, because of it was, we measured water by how the polymerization was going, not by technical, by analysis. And then we used to have to analyze and find out what the problems were, because we recycled solvent, not the way you would do in a full-scale commercial plant. And that was kind of an interesting challenge to get the water analysis. Well, first of all, you didn't have mass spec GCs the way you do now. Analysis is much easier. We used Keldol from it to find out what the water was.
What's that?
You take a bomb, a sample bomb, and make sure that you get a good sample, which is tough. And then you take it to the lab and you use a Keldol method. And if you ask me right now what that is, I don't know. To get down to the parts per million of water. In 1961, getting it to part per million was a real bear. Mm-hmm. Now it's, you know, we're falling off a lot. That was one. So the whole recycle situation. And I remember, you know, you start plants on holidays like Christmas Eve. And we have problems with the extrusion because what happened with ethylene propylene copolymer, you got it, you got the solid, put it through a filter, and then took it through an extruder.
Mm.
And if it isn't properly, adequately polymerized, you get sort of soup out of this extruder, and it isn't very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And the plant was going nuts. And so we were going nuts trying to figure out what the problems were. Anyway, those were the two major problems.
How did you troubleshoot a problem like that? I'm just looking for a general.
Well, you'd look at what the plant, take it back to the lab. You take the material and put it through a column and see what the distribution was. You'd see whether, you'd analyze for left catalyst if the catalyst wasn't properly used. You looked at the solvent to see what the solvent problems were. So you did a real, you know, process analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it corrects itself. This is the maddening part. You know, it corrects itself and you don't know what's going on. The real problem, one of the real problems was that we were not adequately drying the solvent. And because the system didn't allow for that. And when we were in the pilot plant, we didn't have that problem because we used Winston solvent. And you know, it resolved itself. And, so the chemical was making, or engine was making a thin propylene polymer quite well. I don't know where it stands now.
And so
I spent a year and a half on that and then transferred into the petroleum side.
So I was going to ask two things, because you were in Baton Rouge. You went up to...
almost 3 years in Baton
Rouge. And then you wound up, headed up to Florham Park, Jersey.
And in my case, that was a voluntary transfer. It was requested.
Okay. I was going to ask.
But I was in the petroleum side in the lab still.
Okay. I was going to ask whether or not, again, you know, in your graduate school days, you had this interest in the business side of things, whether or not you were satisfied with just working on this process engineering, or if you had an interest in sort of returning to more of the business
strategic side.
Right.
Not at that time. I mean, I thought this was very good, basic, get to know company, get to know people. It was an important first step.
Okay. And how did your move from Baton Rouge to Jersey take place?
Well, okay, now I want